Welcome to The B Word, a podcast about humans, organisations, behaviour. I'm your host, James Healy. If you're anything like me, on the 1st of January every year, you resolve to change your behaviour. To eat healthier, go to the gym more, drink less. And if you're anything like me, most years you fail to change those behaviours. The truth is, changing behaviour is really hard. And if that's a problem for each of us in our own lives, it's a really big problem for governments and organizations looking to change the behavior of consumers, citizens, and employees. If we can't change our own behavior, how on earth do we expect to change anyone else's? In 2010, the then British Prime Minister David Cameron decided to try a new approach to solving this problem. He'd read a behavioral science book, Nudge, by Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein, and thought the techniques in the book could be successfully applied by the British government to help change citizen behaviour. At his request, a small team was set up, the Behavioural Insights Team, which soon became known as the Nudge Unit. Fast forward a decade, and there are more than 200 similar units in governments around the world, and countless others in the private sector. What can we as individuals and organisations learn from these teams? And how can we use behavioural science techniques to change our own behaviour or the behaviour of our consumers and employees? As a founder member of that original team in the UK government, my guest today has some of the answers. Rory Gallagher is Asia Pacific Managing Director of the Behavioural Insights Team and has been with BIT since its inception in 2010. Based in Sydney since 2012, Rory led the establishment of the New South Wales Department of Premier and Cabinet's Behavioural Insights Unit, the first Australian agency dedicated to applying behavioural science to public policy. Rory holds a PhD in Health and Behaviour Change from Cambridge University and has been a visiting fellow at the Singapore Civil Service College since 2014. Prior to joining BIT, Rory worked in the UK Prime Minister's Strategy Unit and the UK Department of Education. He's the co-author of the 2017 book, Think Small, The Surprisingly Simple Ways to Reach Big Goals. Afternoon, Rory. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So let's start by talking about your book. Can you tell us a bit about how thinking small can help us achieve big things?
Thanks. So yeah, I think it's been 4 or so years now since we published. And really, it was to bring together what we had learned about sort of nudging in our day jobs and starting to apply that to our own personal lives. So the book is really a sort of a mindset as well as 7 steps that you can use to break down sort of big goals into more achievable steps. The sort of primary motivator for that being that many organizations, many governments, many individuals set these lofty goals and strategies, but you often fail to take the necessary steps and put in place the sort of what we call the necessary behavioral scaffolding in order for us to achieve those goals. So we know that most of our good intentions are never followed through on. Most of our New Year's resolutions are broken before the end of January, and most of our sort of organizational goals and strategies and policies are never realized. And the book is really an attempt to think through what are the steps that you can take to make it more likely that you succeed in those goals, whether, you know, in your personal life or at work.
Awesome. And what are some of those steps, and how do you think organizations can look to apply those in their context?
So the first step is really about setting the right type of goals and then planning how you get there. And actually, I think we make as many mistakes of this in our personal life as we do in our organizations as well. So we often pursue personal goals which are either unrealistic or which are unlikely to actually improve our well-being or make us better off, and therefore we fairly quickly lose motivation. And you often see that within organizations. We sort of have these big audacious goals, but they're often measuring things which isn't really sort of aligned with the organization's mission or purpose. So there's lots I think we can learn about setting the right types of goals and then how you sit down and make plans to make that happen. Maybe one other that I'll call out is around incentives and feedback mechanisms. We often we often get those wrong, both in our personal lives and in our organizations. And you can find that where you get those incentives wrong, not only do they not work, but sometimes they can backfire. And importantly, we often don't set up the necessary feedback loop. So we don't know how we're tracking often until it is too late. And we'll see in our personal lives, increasingly, you can see the importance of these real-time feedback mechanisms. So, you know, many of us now have Fitbits or Garmin watches or, you know, whatever technology you prefer on our persons. And they give us all sorts of useful information now about when to move, about how many steps that we're taking each day. And for me, as a very occasional runner, I know the difference between when I can see my pace and when I'm sort of running in a more deliberative way to a time versus just going out for a jog. You can see there's a real uptick in my performance where I have a clear idea of the distance and time that I'm running from and when I just go out for a jog. And the same is true in many of our organization and our day jobs, where we have very clear goals and we have very clear metrics which tell us how we're tracking to achieve that. We often see good organizational performance. And when we set those big lofty goals and then you don't really hear much until mid-year review or to the end of financial quarter, then often we track and perform less well.
Yeah, I think that's very valid. And the point around incentives is key in organizations. We see that so often. Organizations want a particular outcome or say they want a particular outcome and then incentivize a different behavior. I like the analogy to personal fitness and, you know, the use of Fitbits, et cetera. Along those lines, there's one other technique that you refer to in the book, and I love this, not least because it refers to football teams. So what does wearing an Arsenal shirt have to do with meeting one's fitness goals?
It's a great old example now from actually when I was first part of the team, and one of the first times I actually applied these techniques to my own life. So this was in one of my previous attempts to get fit. I had tried joining various gyms, some near my house, some nicer gyms, which were, you know, I kind of thought that was the incentive that I was using by spending out on expensive gym membership that would in some way hook me in to going. But it turned out that just wasn't the case. And often at the end of a long working day, I didn't fancy going to the nice gym by my house. So I transferred that gym membership to the gym, which was on site, much less swanky, much cheaper, but importantly on site. And so I could use it more immediately before or after work and sort of stop some of those self excuses. But having done that, I still failed to often follow through on my good intentions. And so one day we're talking about the use of commitment devices, which at the time we were using in employment centres. I tried to think about how do we apply that in our own lives. So in the employment centre example, we were asking job seekers to actually specifically commit to when they were going to look and how they were going to look for work. So usually in our employment systems, we just say to people, right, you need to go and look for 3 jobs this week, and we leave that up to them. And we really work with employment centers and advisors to sit down and step out with people, not just, you know, broadly that they were going to look for work, but what they were going to do after breakfast on Thursday. They were going to go to the high street and speak to some certain retailers. And that we found helped motivate both the job center staff and the job seekers to follow through those good intentions. So I thought I would try and leverage that insight in my own life. And I wrote up on that whiteboard that I would go to the gym 3 times per week for the next month. And if I didn't, I would have to buy and wear a Robin Van Persie Arsenal shirt. And in that case, Arsenal was the team of my bitter rivals, of the team that I support, Tottenham Hotspur. And the thought of that, the social stigma and shame with which that would I would feel, was much more of a motivator than giving myself $50 or a meal out. In this case, the motivation of having to wear that was much stronger. And there's a broader notion there to think about what are those types of incentives and disincentives that are really going to motivate you or your staff.
As a Leeds fan, that really resonates with me, and particularly since I had the great misfortune of living in Islington in 2004, which was a season both when Arsenal went invincible and when Leeds were relegated. So I have a particular loathing for Arsenal.
A terrible time.
Not the subject of this podcast. Anyway, I like the analogy here between using things in your personal life that you'd used in organization or in, you know, a government context. And I'm keen to talk now about some of your work with both the UK government and the New South Wales government, also BIT more broadly. What are some of the most successful behavioral change techniques that you've employed?
Yeah, so there's obviously a variety of tools and techniques that come from the behavioral science literature. And again, after the sort of first 5 years of applying that, we started to think about what are, exactly your question, the most common and effective levers that we can pull in order to change behavior. So we came up with what was called the EAST framework, which is, if you want someone to do something, make it easy, attractive, social, and timely. And while the sort of nuance and some of the sub techniques of that have changed and evolved over time, our view is that, you know, a decade later, those four levers still remain some of the most common and powerful today. So just to make that concrete, make it easy. How do you strip away some of the frictions and sludge that we have within our organizational processes? How do you make communications really easy to see? How do you take the sort of one click, one touch concept and apply it? So you make it as easy as possible for someone to do the behavior that you wish. And that sounds extremely trite, but it is incredible how many of the challenges that we work on, the issues we work on, where we are, you know, perplexed why someone isn't following through or behaving the way that we expect. And when you actually look at the process and the barriers, you realize that we've created lots of hurdles in that person's way. So make it easy is one of our most common go-to approaches. We then have make it attractive, which is how do you cut through and grab people's attentions, particularly in this day and age where, you know, we have thousands of decisions to make. We're bombarded with information. How do you get your piece of communication or your issue to the top of the mental in tray for people and the various techniques you can use there? Make it social is really how do you use social norms and networks to make it more likely that you will follow through. Again, let's go back to another sporting analogy. I often find that when I'm running around a park near where I live, the other thing that makes me go a lot faster if there is someone else running around that I can sort of follow. And you'll often see the same works. That's why gym classes and actually why many organizational sort of structures are effective, because we are motivated by those around us and those accountability mechanisms. And finally, make it timely. How do you actually think about the right time to change your behavior? That might be in someone's life course. It might be at particular times of your reporting or financial year, or the sort of points of the process. And again, we've seen many gains that can be had just by using simple prompts or nudges at the right moment can be enough to get that bump up to shift the dial in terms of whether people follow through or not.
I love the EAST framework, and I love how simple it makes what is such a complicated subject. And I think there's lots of lessons that people can learn and lots of ways that people can apply those techniques both to their personal lives, also within organizations. Staying with organizations, keen to discuss some of the areas that you see as ripe for organizations to use behavioral change, use behavioral science techniques. What are some of those key opportunities and challenges that organizations are facing that have that behavioral solution?
I think there are several. An area where we have done quite a lot of work over the last few years is around diversity and inclusion and de-biasing many of our internal processes, including recruitment. And actually, if I sort of cast my mind back, it's quite interesting. I think it's interesting that I was quite happy to admit my sort of personal failings in the health or the sports arena or even the sort of financial savings arena. And so would use these nudges and techniques on myself. But when I talked about and I thought about my recruitment processes and judgment, I was very reluctant to think that I might be have my own biases, that I might be prone to hiring people that look and sound and act a little bit like me. And when we first built a tool which essentially blinded us to people's background, all of their demographics, where they were educated, where they what they studied and their career history, you know, I was nervous at first. I thought, you know, actually, well, you know, how do we tell people's sort of, you know, what they've studied, and, you know, surely I can make those type of judgments better if I have that information at my fingertips. And it was a real sort of learning process over a couple of rounds, and actually probably couples of years, to realize, of course, I was much less effective at choosing the right candidate than these systems which aggregate scores across anonymized applicants. So we've done lots of work to think about how do we de-bias recruitment, as well as how do we increase progression, particularly of women in senior leadership positions within government and organizations. And I think there is still a huge opportunity in that space. And if I just think about, you know, more contemporary sort of issue that's front of mind for me and our team and our organization at the minute, is return to workplaces. We can see with restrictions lifting in Sydney, so we're in mid-October 2021 at the minute, and restrictions are starting to lift in Sydney and soon to follow, hopefully, other states. And there's lots of organizations thinking about how do we actually manage that return to the workplace effectively? How do we do that in a way which gives staff empowerment, but also gets over coordination issues? And we sort of saw some pretty surprising trends when we went back into lockdown in Australia. Some of those sort of benefits that we saw of remote and hybrid working were actually less sticky than we had anticipated, and people sort of fairly quickly dropped back into old routines, the 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, despite the major changes. So we're doing work now to think about how do we actually lock in some of the benefits that we've seen from remote and hybrid working, but also get over some of the coordination issues and allow and enable some of the things that we know are done better in person, or it feels the evidence suggests are done in person, you know, particularly onboarding of new staff, building sort of culture and morale, and specific types of collaboration tasks. So that's something where I think we are still learning. The evidence is growing, but feels a huge opportunity right now.
It's a double-edged sword, because it feels like there are a lot of challenges to overcome in terms of that reintegration, but there's also an opportunity for a fresh start. And it's that kind of fresh start effect that we see so often. So I think organizations need to be very deliberate about what they do and see it as an opportunity to reinvent culture, reinvent ways of working, rather than just try and return to the way things were before. But the challenge with that is, of course, that everyone's got a day job, everyone's busy, time slips by, and the opportunity is missed. Have you got any advice for organizations on how to counter that?
I think your point about the fresh start effect is a really good one. So there is a period of time, which is pretty much now and probably to the end of the calendar year, where people will still be sort of re-establishing those new habits, probably right up until the new year. So there is a period of a couple of months where you can engage staff and set up, as you exactly the point you made, how do you do this deliberatively rather than sort of purely, you know, employee-led and sort of slightly chaotic. So one of the issues that we know organizations face is, particularly if rightly they allow staff to choose sort of when they come in, you can often have these coordination problems where when they come to the office, you don't have the critical mass, or you haven't set up the systems that really enable you to tap into some of the things that are best done in person, some of the social cultural elements and collaboration. So exactly as you said, it's how do you actually set up the right sort of parameters, reduce some of those coordination issues, and really enable sort of that collaboration to occur in person in the most sort of efficient and effective way.
Look, we're on the topic of the pandemic. I don't know what people used to talk about before we had a pandemic to discuss all the time. Let's stay with that for a moment. What are some of the lessons that you think can be learned about behavioral change from the last 18 months, 2 years, this great global behavioral change experiment that we've stumbled into?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And I think there are lots of lessons. And many of which I'm sure have got a long way to go before we fully understand them. I mean, one of the first lessons for us is the scale of behavior change that is possible when the sort of incentives or the forces are pointing in the right way. The sort of, you know, we have talked for a long time about the benefits of flexible working and hybrid working and remote working, and faced all sorts of organizational inertia. And actually, you know, we've seen how quickly organizations and individuals were able to respond and work productively under those circumstances when their hand was forced. And we saw that in many domains. Our sort of everything from our shopping to the way we spend our time, our behaviors radically, radically changed in ways we probably couldn't have imagined pre-pandemic. And in fact, many of the interventions and behaviors that I'm involved in are focused on much more marginal changes and much more, you know, 5-10% changes in behavior, whereas we saw radical, radical changes during the pandemic. Now, of course, once we are in the new normal, those types of radical changes are probably not possible. But what are the things that we can learn about being more daring and trying to support more radical change when necessary? The other one, which is slightly more nerdy and technocratic, is the methods that we use. So Behavioral Insights, and particularly Behavioral Insights team, have relied very heavily on field experiments in order to test some of our hypotheses. So we think this particular intervention or change to a process is going to work, but does it actually play out in practice? Many of the timescales, and partly because of we're all working remotely and people aren't attending schools or workplaces, has meant that we couldn't run those types of field experiments. And so we were forced to draw on other methods that were already evolving, sort of rapid online tests and sort of consumer testing. And we've relied on that very heavily over the last couple of years. And I think there've been some real benefits to that, both to sharpen up our use of those tools and to actually show that you can do these testings under very tight timelines and tight time pressures. So in many cases, you know, we'd be having to come up with a new communications approach to, you know, if we think right back to the start, to encouraging people to wash their hands through the pandemic, to wearing masks, to stay at home and now get vaccinated. And we've had to sort of empirically test those using different methods. And I think that's shone a light back onto us to think about the variety of tools and some of the rapidity of the tests that we can use going forward.
So it's now, I guess, 10, 11 years, correct me on the date, but it's 10, 11 years since the original Behavioural Insights team was set up in the UK government. It's, I think, 13, 14 years since the publication of Nudge. And that book has now been reissued in final form. It's a good opportunity for you, as someone who's been part of this since the very beginning, to reflect. What are your key reflections on behavioral insights and applied behavioral science and where it's gone over the last decade, decade and a half?
Yeah, I think it is a really good moment to reflect and look back, but to also plot that path forwards. And I think there are a couple of different ways we can view it and to think about the way forward. The glass half full approach to it, in my mind, is to really, if you look at the updated version of Nudge and we look back on a decade of our work, is the sort of outsized impact that these methods, tools, and teams have had. So, you know, if we cast our mind back to 2010 when the team was set up with half a dozen people, you know, that is a very different situation to now, where we have hundreds of team around the world in organizations, in corporates, and in governments applying these tools and techniques. So, you know, there really has been a global movement. And many of those teams have been successful because they're able to prove the impact of their work. And so our understanding about how these play out and work in different contexts has radically increased. So we had huge amounts of evidence from academia and from lab studies, but over the last decade, we've been able to see how does this work and not work in practice. So our understanding of what works in different contexts has deeply grown. And I definitely think we have moved up the policy cycle and the complexity of the behaviors which we are trying to tackle. So I think there's a lot to be proud of and to reflect on in terms of that growth. And I think a lot of it has been collaboration with academia. It has been the willingness to experiment and fail and to share those insights more widely across the community. I think the glass half empty is, you know, have we gone far enough? And, you know, do we have as yet a body of work around, you know, really high impact policy interventions, around really scaled interventions that we would have sort of wanted or dreamed of by this stage? Probably not. You know, have we made a dent in some of the really big wicked problems? I would argue in some, you know, so for example, the introduction of the sugar tax or the sweetened beverage tax in the UK is a good example of a big policy lever to tackle a wicked problem. But it is certainly true that we haven't made as big an inroad on some of those big policy problems as we would want. And I think there is also a challenge for us that we have sometimes let the sort of method drive the intervention. So our desire to test and to run randomized controlled trials has forced us and units to work on issues which can be trialed and experimented and can be relatively quickly measured and evaluated. And that has come with its sort of narrowing of some of the work. And we've seen, you know, certainly we can often get pigeonholed, or we can often get put to fixing downstream parts of systems and problems rather than tackling their root cause. So there's a bit of a job for us overthink collectively over the next decade to think about how we challenge that narrative, increase the breadth and depth of our interventions and our methodological tools. And the other reflection that I probably have is that we've also often relied, we can have our biggest impact where we change the intervention, the environment within which people are operating, often at an automatic level. So, you know, changing the defaults or changing the system and stripping out some of the sludge that we've seen be very, very effective time and time again. But for some of those complex problems, you know, we require more engaged behaviors, we require sort of new habits to form. And so I think there is all sorts of things for us to learn and still learn about those difference between when we're changing more sort of system one automatic behaviors and when we need to engage our sort of system two behaviors through sort of boosts or nudge plus, as it's sometimes now referred to.
Thanks. And I think there's a lot to talk about there. I'm trying to synthesize that. What would your key recommendations or your key tips be for organizations who are looking to get into using behavioral science or behavioral change techniques, maybe set up their own team or their own small scale kind of trial of this?
I think there are a couple. One is to be working on the right issue and the right mix of portfolio of projects. So it is pretty clear, and we often used to say, you know, start with the low-hanging fruit, the low risk where you can make a difference relatively quickly. That links to the point I just made, though, is that we've sometimes then become pigeonholed around, well, that's all we do, right, is to change letters or change communications or send text messages, because that's the first few trials or projects that you run. So I would always try and make sure that if you are doing those low-hanging fruit, there is a clear line that they are chipping away and making an impact on your organization's sort of strategic priorities. And there is a clear roadmap or plan that once you've proved yourself and you've started to hone those tools, you can start to apply them to bigger challenges and more complex behaviors. I think where we don't have that, and you just sort of, you can often stay with the low-hanging fruit and you don't unleash the full potential. I've also seen it the other way, where people go, well, we don't need to do any of that sort of more transactional simple stuff. We'll go straight in and apply these tools to really tricky problems. And then they haven't then established that track record of success. So choosing the right sort of balance of projects that all contribute to organizational priorities would be one. And then second would be to take an experimental mindset. As I said, that doesn't just mean running RCTs, but it does mean setting up success measures to see and learn if what you wanted worked or not, and to have a sort of fail fast mentality. And I would say again, look, with my hand on my heart, that we often preach that we need to run these experiments and all results are a good result. If you get a null result, it is still positive because you've learned if something's worked or not. But of course, it is true that it is disappointing if you put your heart and soul into an intervention and then it doesn't work. And there's certainly things I've been involved in where, you know, it's been a successful evaluation because it's shown that something hasn't worked, but it doesn't always feel as good. And certainly there is a job to do to bring senior execs with you, that if things don't work, that can still be regarded as a positive because you're not then wasting money on things that don't work. But you need to get that balance of success and failures and calibrate in our executives' minds. And if you are going to take this experimental mindset, the edgier you are, the harder the challenges that you're taking on, you know, the higher the risk that these things won't work.
I think that's a really great point, and it's a conversation I've had a lot. Are we willing to try something and fail? I think the other big thing to call out from an organizational perspective from what you said is this view that behavioral science is about incremental change and it's about nudges, it's about the kind of Jedi mind tricks. Often in organizations, and you've alluded to it a number of times today, there are some really big boulders, there are some really big barriers to behavioral change: organizational structures, incentive structures, technology. And I think there is a real need to bring the behavioral lens to those things and not regard behavioral change as something that you do on top of implementing a system or changing an org structure. It's got to be at the core of that.
I think that's exactly right. And I think as sort of applied behavioral scientist, certainly with BIT, we are learning how to do that better. It is certainly, as you sort of made the point, I think very nicely, that you have to do that almost organizational systems thinking at the same time as you are trying to understand the discrete behavior. So exactly the point you make, how do you really understand what's driving incentives and performance and reporting mechanisms and board structures and decision structures? You need to understand all of that if you're then, you know, really to understand how you change behaviors in a particular sort of change circumstance. So I think there is a lot more for us to learn. I think we've become pretty good at changing individuals' behaviors within systems, but how we change sort of organizations and teams' behavior by having a much better sense of how these organizational dynamics work is something I think collectively as a field we can and should get better at.
We've talked a lot about things that we can do better, and I would like to now talk about some of the challenges or some of the criticisms of using behavioral science. I think I recall reading somewhere that when you arrived in Australia, you were greeted with a very warm and welcoming headline, the sort of which would be familiar to English cricketers arriving in Australia. It wasn't quite Stuart Broad and the Brisbane Courier Mail, but from memory, it was something like, a very bad idea is coming to Australia. What was that bad idea, and what was the gist of the objection to this?
Yeah, a very warm welcome indeed. And again, look, I try not to take it too personally. I thought it was the idea rather than the carrier of the idea. But I think that the central concern was this thought that behavioral scientists or psychologists would be working at the heart of government to change behavior. And that seemed quite a scary thing. And of course, you know, that it was often from a climate of not knowing the types of intervention. So it was sort of a fear-based narrative without a sense of what are the sorts of things that you're going to be doing. And very quickly, those fears went away when, you know, after a couple of years, we were able to publish work that showed it was helping, you know, teachers get back to work faster, or it was encouraging people to turn up to their hospital appointment. Often, you know, people could see, you know, clear sort of social goods in what we were doing. And also, you know, the sort of counter narrative that is often not thought about is if you are trying to influence behavior, which governments, of course, are, do you really just want to rely on lawyers and economists and historians who are often sort of at the wheels of power within government? Wouldn't it be better to have people that understood human behavior trying to shape those systems and decisions? And I think over time, there has been this recognition that policymakers and nudgers have their own biases. And actually, through having multiple perspectives, by bringing designers on board, by bringing organizational psychologists, by bringing frontline staff and their perspectives in, we have a much richer and better insight into how we design our policies, services, and organizations.
I think there is a lot of fear around this from people who don't understand it. And again, it's that fear that it's Jedi mind tricks, and particularly when you bring sort of behavioral science and data science together, this conjunction of big data and behavioral change. Do you have any thoughts on that as a future direction, particularly in an organizational context?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I was actually speaking to an academic about this today. And it is one of my greatest, I guess, hopes and opportunities, as well as one of my greatest fears. And we will see, I think, actually, the sort of Cambridge Analytica scandal actually set this back a long way, because that was using data in unethical ways and targeting people, you know, at an individual and a group level, using lots of fear-based messaging, etc. But it was the use of sort of data and personality tests in quite unethical ways. But the ability to tailor and target these interventions has to be, in my view, the way forward. So when we started out, and still sometimes to this day, you know, we are designing services at the aggregate level. And that can't be, you know, the most effective way. If you're designing a support for a job seeker, it is very likely that the type of things that work for an 18-year-old that's sort of leaving school for the first time are different to someone who's been working in the industry for 20 years and has been laid off versus COVID, versus someone who has sort of been in and out of jobs for the last sort of decade. And actually thinking about how do we design our services around better use of data, a better understanding of what's driving, what the barriers are for people, in my mind, is a real opportunity, but we have to get that balance right. And if we don't, the public won't trust us, whether that's organizations or governments, they won't get that right. And we've seen examples of that happen when, you know, people buy a pregnancy test from a major retailer and then get sent lots of baby sort of products. And, you know, people can often think, you know, that is a step far too far, that sort of targeted marketing. So I think we will have to sort of navigate this carefully as we go, but the better, you know, better use of data and more tailored interventions, I think holds huge promise if we can get that citizen engagement and transparency right.
Look, we're ending there on a hopeful note. So one final question with that in mind, with the big fresh start in Sydney, what are your personal fitness goals coming out of COVID, and which behavioral science techniques are you going to use this time?
You've actually caught me on a rather difficult day, because me and my partner are just discussing the rota within which we can take this on, because I think there is actually probably a slightly more serious point I can make, that when I wrote that book, it was 4 years ago, before I had a family, and probably, you know, in terms of personal goals, had less structural constraints than I do now. And actually, the sort of planning that is required to go for a jog now is far higher than it was, you know, pre-kids. And, you know, there's a slightly bigger point for me there, which, as this approach has evolved, understanding of sort of structural constraints, systemic constraints, as well as, you know, the opportunities around data, I think are, you know, hold huge promise. And so for me, I guess the key things I will be focusing on is that routine, about trying to make sure that you have it scheduled in. And for me, that means sort of accountability with friends. I'm much better at going to play squash with friends and football with friends than I am going to the gym or running individually. So a combination of what can I do at home and easy, and what are those things that I can do to tap into my social network.
I hear you on the structural constraints. Rory, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much. It's been very insightful and very entertaining.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
For those of us struggling with New Year's resolutions, whatever the time of year, there's plenty to work with there. Rory shared lots of really simple, practical, real-life tips, many of which are just as applicable in an organizational context as in our personal lives. Simple techniques like commitment devices can have a really powerful impact, and I just love the idea of a forfeit, particularly if it involves wearing your arch rival's football shirt. If you're not familiar with the EAST framework, then I definitely recommend checking that out. There's a lot to be said for making behavioral change easy, attractive, social, and timely. But the key takeaway for me is that point around behavioral scaffolding. So much of human behavior is shaped by environment. If we want to change behavior in our own lives or in our organizations, we need to shape the environment in which that behavior occurs. You've been listening to The B Word, a podcast produced by Margot Zunis and Emma Stewart, and presented by me, James Healy.